It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 2.3.
Wishing our pets were aposymbionts, except, of course, for that whole icky death part.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And with us today, we have Lauren Bukas from South Africa, author of Moxieland and the upcoming, well, at least upcoming in the U.S., Zoo City. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So I guess the first big question is, what is Zoo City about for those that on this side of the ocean who are just now going to get it?
That's actually a ridiculously hard question. wow. It's about crime and magic and guilt and redemption and refugees and a girl with a sloth on her back who has the magical ability to find lost things. And she's a former convict and she writes 419 scams or email scams for a living to pay off her drug debts. And she gets asked to find a missing pop star. And that's when things get really complicated.
Well, that wasn't that hard.
Yeah, I'm missing out a whole bunch of stuff.
Well, that was like the Cliff Notes version of what the book is
about.
Yeah. That works. As you mentioned, you know, it's a crime novel, a noir crime novel specifically. And yet you've included some very fantastical elements, such as the aposymbiotes, like the sloth on her back, the undertow, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, but Muti. Could you explain the origins of these things and tell us what made you decide to write a fantasy murder mystery?
I never set out to write a specific kind of book. With Zoo City, I just had the image in my head of a girl pulling a sloth onto her back, like a backpack. I knew it was a burden, but also the possibility of redemption. And I knew that she was going to get into serious trouble, and I knew that she lived in Hillbrow in Johannesburg's inner city. And it kind of developed from there. But it is based on several existing ideas. The one is, these kind of weird spirit animals which emerge out of nowhere, and it kind of starts in 1996, and it becomes known as the acquired aposymbiote disorder. And it's almost a plague that happens. And that obviously riffs off kind of major pandemics, but it also riffs off the idea of animism and spirit animals, you know, magical totems. And in South Africa, a very specific idea of the Mashavi. It's a traditional African belief, and it is that there are lost spirits of the ancestors who get detached from their families, and they wander lost, and eventually they attach themselves to an animal. And that animal might attach itself to you, whether that ancestor is good or bad, and an influence for good or bad is another story. But no one in the book really actually knows what the animals are, and I'm afraid I don't ever properly explain it, because I also want to leave that up to you. I think there are mysteries in the world, and I think it's more interesting to have mysteries in the world and to let people imagine what they want.
Right. When I told my dad what the story was about, he was like, well, she can always have a sequel to explain what
exactly.
The aposymbiotes really are. I was like, oh yeah, that would probably work. What about Muti? Am I saying
Muti,
that right?
Yeah, it's Muti. So yeah, you are. Muti is traditionally a medical practice. It's using herbalism, but also divination, using the spirits of the ancestors to guide you, very similar to Chinese ancestor worship. And a Sangoma, a traditional healer, or an Inyanga, who is a herbalist, will diagnose you, consulting with the ancestors to find out what's going wrong, and they will then diagnose, treat you with herbs and possibly medicine made out of animal parts as well. There is a dark side to Muti, which of course is the side which gets horribly sensationalized, which is Muti murders, where people are killed for their body parts, and those body parts make particularly strong Muti. And typically the victim has to be alive, and the body part will correspond to a particular kind of medicine. So, for example, if you are a member of parliament and you are facing a particularly difficult debate, you might need brains to get through that. And they could be vulture brains, but the brains of a child would be even more powerful. But right. The brains would have to be taken out while the person was still alive. This doesn't happen a lot, but obviously it is headline grabbing. But it was something I wanted to play with. But I wanted to also show the good side of Muti and, you know, not the sensationalized side as well.
Right. And the United States, we tend to get the sensationalized side of
Muti. It's okay. We get the sensationalized side of your stuff as well. So.
Right, exactly. Well, I think that's all we have over here. okay. In relation to this, what made you decide, like, Zinzi, the main character, has a sloth for her aposymbiote, and then her power of sorts, which I think you refer to as Mashavi specifically, if
yes.
I'm not wrong, is finding lost things. For your other characters, did you see a connection between what their powers were and what their animals were, or is it just kind of random?
I think everything's kind of determined by their personality.
Okay.
And it's very much matched up to who they are, but also what the story needed. And I think, you know, like, you don't really know whether the animals are good or bad, but I think that also comes through in the person. I think it's the possibility of what they do with their animals, but their animals do also have an influence.
Oh, well, I guess just kind of changing gears, because something that I really liked about this book was that you interweave these sort of alternate storytelling devices. Like, for example, you have the whole line with the 419 scammer email, and then you have this long section about the documentary with the, you know, it's full set up with all of the details about the movie, and then these little reviews, which I kind of laugh because there's the one really awful review with the dirty link, or what is, I'm presuming is a dirty link, which
yep.
I thought was funny. So I'm really curious, what was kind of your inspiration for sort of putting all of these things together into this book?
Well, using those kind of excerpts and found objects was because I really, really despise painful exposition. You know, that moment where the characters sit down in the bar and say, so, what is an aposymbiote? And can you explain that to me? And how did you get the sloth on your back? It's just painful and awful. And I also wanted to entrench this as much as possible in the real world, which meant bringing in real world elements. And a lot of authors have done this. I think my main inspiration was probably Alan Moore, where he brings in a lot of different elements, which you can skip, but really bring a richness and a depth and a whole different understanding to the story. But I think the main motivation was just trying not to do painful exposition.
that's a really
but it was
good
also idea. It was also some. Sorry, I interrupted you. So much fun to play with these different elements, to write kind of, you know, these ridiculous comments and really to try and develop those different voices. And what was really cool was I got some other writers to contribute as well. And the stuff they came up with was wild. It was amazing to see other writers playing in my world and inventing stuff that I wouldn't actually have come up with on my own. That was awesome.
I have to ask real quick. The Warlord with the Penguin. Was that you or one of the other
yeah.
writers?
No, that was me. That was me. It had to be a Warlord with a Penguin. I actually got great fan art. Somebody sent me a fantastic drawing of that. It was amazing.
It was I was stunned the first time you said it, mentioned it in the book. I just was like, what? It's so incongruous. I just loved it and I had to mention it. Also, the 419 scam, the very first one that you do, I think it was interesting because I read this on my Nook, so I don't know how the layout is compared to a print novel. And the 419 scam that you included right in the beginning had me absolutely completely fooled. I was convinced that it was part of the story because there was no difference between it and the narrative part directly before it in terms of, yet stylistically point of view, it was a little bit different. And it obviously wasn't Zinzi talking, but at the same time, it seemed to flow rather naturally from the section before it. And by the end of it, I think it took me until the very last paragraph to realize that it was a scam. And I realized that this is... You know, the scams that I've gotten, 419 scams that I've gotten over the years, have been pretty much crap. So is that actually something, is it more common for 419 scams to be that good?
No, it's fairly uncommon. There are,
okay.
I did a lot of research on 419 scams, actually, and I spent some time talking to cops who work in the 419 scam unit in South Africa, because a lot of the scammers who are often based in West Africa will use Johannesburg as a point of contact, where they'll actually meet with their victims and spin them this entire big, giant story and extract even more money out of them. But because Johannesburg is a lot it's perceived as a much safer and more civilized location than some other places, I think especially after the World Cup, it makes it credible. So I did a lot of investigation into these stories. There are scammers who are incredibly sophisticated and quite terrifying. I think the most disgusting kind of scam is the charity scams, where they'll pretend to be the Red Cross or an organization that helps feed starving children. Or especially after a disaster. I mean, there'll be 419 scams set up immediately after something like the earthquake in Haiti. And it's horrendous. These guys can be really evil, but a lot of them, as you said, are just stupid and bad. But I think Zinzi definitely stands out. I think, that's why they're so keen on using her. Because she has a bit of an imagination, because she can spin out this really crazy story, which seems so credible. And, as you said, it had you fooled. It's fantastic to hear.
Oh, yeah, completely fooled. I felt like such a dupe. And so once you started talking to the victims later on, I was like, oh, wow, I totally feel for these guys now, because I could definitely see how it could happen with stories that credible. It's hard to say with the ones that, like, I've gotten over the years, you kind of look at them and go, what idiots are falling for this?
Okay, but I think one of the women I interviewed when I wrote stories about 419 scams for Cosmopolitan and Marie Claire magazine in South Africa. It's always nice to tie my research to paying journalism work. And one of the victims I interviewed, she was from Chile. She was originally from Chile, and her family now lived in Mexico, and she'd flown out to Johannesburg 3 times. And she says these guys were so convincing, and they wore suits, and they met her at the Joburg Stock Exchange. And she also found their story completely credible, because her mother her grandmother had had to flee Chile under Pinochet.
Right.
So the idea that you might have to flee your country and leave everything you own behind was completely credible to her. Mm-hmm. And I think she lost $100,000, which she'd raised from friends and family. It was just devastating.
I can imagine. Yeah, it was difficult to read, for sure. I mean, just from a human standpoint, the 419 scam that you include is a very difficult part to read. And, I have seen some that seem, you can almost see the human story behind it, but it doesn't seem to be very common. Luckily, for the rest of the world,
absolutely,
they're not very creative. If they were creative, we'd be doomed.
Can I add one thing quickly before we move on to the next question, which is that if you are interested in 419 scams, there's a wonderful site actually run by a South African called scamwarners.com, and also 419eater.com, where they actually scam bait people, which I wouldn't recommend getting involved with, because some of the scammers are violent.
Right.
But, if you know someone being scammed, or you just want to check out the range and depth of scams out there, Scam Warners is actually very interesting.
It's fascinating. Thank you.
Okay, so actually I had a question that was related to that, because they did a documentary a few years ago in the U.S. about 419 scammers, and they did this whole thing where they literally, they scammed the scammers to like do one of those intervention-y things. And I'm very curious, in your research, what kind of people did these, what kind of people were behind these things?
The actual scammers?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't manage to actually speak to a scammer. I tried a couple of times. And I even tried a bit of scam baiting as a way of trying to lure someone out, and they just cut me off. I think they're also getting wise to people scamming, to scam baiting. Right. Generally, I think they're people who are slightly dodgy, but I think they're also coming out of really horrible circumstances. Not that that is an excuse for what they're doing, but I think often, you've got people coming out of poverty, and it's blatant opportunism. They see the possibility of doing this. There's a huge industry in West Africa, the scamming industry, and you'll have whole internet cafes where people just sit and run these kind of things. What's interesting is that it's very carefully decentralized. A lot of people operate independently. It's the same with the drug industry in South Africa, where a lot of the people bring in the drugs from typically West Africa, but we also have triads and that kind of thing. They're typically decentralized, and there are all these kind of independent agents. So if you take out one cluster, the rest are actually unaffected. But yeah, they kind of have scamming. It's not quite scamming schools, but they definitely help people develop formats and that kind of thing.
That's really fascinating. I mean, I just learned recently that they also scam on dating sites too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the worst, because they'll actually scam someone for 4 or 6 months and wow. lead them on, and then suddenly, you know, it might be someone who is apparently working on an oil rig, and he has this accident and he's stuck in Nigeria, and please can this woman send money? She's the love of his life. You know, he really wants to see her, but he's had this accident. The government's threatening him and he's scared, and it's just horrible. It's just really horrible.
Well, they're
I think
the
greed
most...
ones are, in Go some ahead. Ways, I think kind of the greed ones are almost deserved, but the charity scams and the romance scams are vile.
Yes. The most vulnerable people are the ones that are targeted with those, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, we should get back to the book.
Yeah, well, actually, related again to the research was you mentioned on Skype earlier that you did research on Hillbro, that's residential district in Johannesburg, for Zoo City. So I was wondering if you could talk about sort of what you kind of did about while you were researching, and, you know, what was your process for that? And also, in relation to that, I mean, what part of Johannesburg is Zoo City set in, and did you do any kind of particular research for the sort of gritty realism of the Zoo City area?
Well, Zoo City is technically Hillbrow. It's the ghetto where all the zoos or animals are kind of forced into. And Hillbrow used to be this very glamorous, in the 80s, it was this incredibly glamorous, very vibrant, cosmopolitan part of the inner city. And then it became very bohemian, and there was a lot of mixed race stuff going on and huge gay culture. There was an amazing singer called Brenda Fussy, and she was very involved with the Hillbrow scene, and she was a lesbian, but this incredible singer, and it was just this really incredibly vibrant boho society. And then Hillbrow kept sliding down and down and down, and eventually it just became kind of desperate slums. And now you're starting to see a resurgence again of Hillbrow. But I knew that I wanted to set Zoo City in that area. I grew up in Johannesburg, and I know the city very well. And Hillbrow was just absolutely it. There's mad stuff which goes on in Hillbrow. On New Year's Eve, people will throw fridges and televisions off their balconies in their kind of apartment blocks. And there was actually an amazing documentary about the paramedics who hate having to work New Year's Eve in Hillbrow because of the crazy stuff that goes on. But it's also a place where people live, and I really wanted to bring that in. You know, I think we tend to forget that, you know, even in the worst slum areas, that people have to live there. And right. I really wanted to bring that back to that humanity, to show the refugee communities who live there. And obviously, you know, that people with aposymbiotes are naturally relegated to kind of slum areas. They're naturally stigmatized. It's almost a kind of a neo-apartheid system. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to play with that. So I spent several days in Hillbrow with a fixer who's a kind of journalist assistant. There was a Zimbabwean guy called Johnson Sitole. And he showed me around, and we talked to people, and we really just wandered around. It was fantastic. You know, I've done a lot of journalism in my career. I came out of being a journalist. And Moxieland was informed a lot by my journalism, and there's some elements in Zoo City which were informed by stories I've done in the past. But I just had absolute freedom to, like, go and mission through Hillbrow and find the things which interested me and talk to amazing people and really just kind of get a sense of place. And that was really phenomenal. And I'm just very glad Johnson offered to bring his gun, and I was like, no, it's fine. I really actually don't want you to do that. But, yeah, but, I mean, the one place I went which didn't make it into the book, because it was so shocking and so devastating, was the Central Methodist Church, which is home to about 4,000 Zimbabwean refugees. And it was just... it was the worst place I've ever been. It was interesting, you know, I mean, obviously people are just, they're trying to make the best of a really, really bad situation, and these people have nowhere else to go, and the church is absolutely it.
Right.
But it was just shocking, and the crowding, and I never realized that dehumanizing wasn't something you did to other people, it's also something you do to yourself. You know, these people had lost sight of their own humanity. They were so desperate, and it was too big, ultimately, to put in the book. The whole book would have had to become about that. But I still wanted to bring those refugee stories in, which is why I focused on Zinzi's boyfriend, Benoit.
Right. The Central Methodist Church is... they were kind of at the center of the killings in 2008, correct?
Well, then,
or
they
am
were
I totally mixing them up?
No, you're right, but they were at the center for providing refuge.
Providing refuge, and then it was, yes, yeah, no, sorry.
Huge distinction.
More specific, yes. They were providing refuge for refugees at the time, and then there were attacks on them, correct?
Yes, and in 2008 we saw a huge outbreak of xenophobic attacks in South Africa against other Africans, right. Where Zimbabweans attacked, Somalians were attacked, And it was very violent and very traumatic, and a lot of people were terrified, and the Central Methodist Church was one place where people took refuge, and there are amazing photos online of that time and of people. But the thing is that, you know, everyone thinks that those attacks are over now, but they're not. People are still living in fear, and they're still living in these horrendous conditions, and it's all but forgotten about.
Right.
And that's kind of alarming. That's also something I wanted to bring in with Zoo City, that, you know, it's an ongoing thing. It's not a battle. It's an ongoing war.
Mm-hmm. No, it was one of, to me, one of the more compelling components of the book was Benoit's story. And yeah, I absolutely love that part. Sorry. Trying to think about it in terms of, you know, it's like, it's interesting because the United States, we have our own xenophobia, you know, and you can see the progression in the United States from people not worrying too much about immigration and then suddenly being, you know, utterly terrified about it and the people targeting the people. We haven't had killings yet.
Or not many. Nothing on that level. Yeah.
Not on that level, exactly. We don't have, you know, mobs or anything. But it is something that is happening in the United States. And it happens in a lot of places. And South Africa is unique in that, you know, these people are specifically refugees. And to come to leave one place of war and come to find, you know, that they're targeted again is, you know, it's an interesting story and a heartbreaking story. So
absolutely.
And it's interesting because you mentioned that this last issue just happened in 2008, was that correct?
Yes.
So, and then you mentioned that already it seems like we've forgotten, or at least in South Africa they've forgotten. I was not familiar with it. It's kind of odd that I wasn't paying attention that particular day, but it seems very odd that I think culturally a lot of us, we just sort of, these major events happen, it kind of ends up on the news, and then we kind of forget it the next year, or we vaguely remember it, unless it's something, you know, like in the U.S., like, they'll never let us forget 9/11, because it's an attack on the country, and, like, we'll never forget that, but, you know, all of these little events that happen in the country, we forget them all the time, and I'm wondering if, you know, since you do talk about the intersection of technology, and particularly in Moxieland, but even a little bit in Zoo City, it's a little bit there in terms of like the 419 scams and, you know, you do have Amazon and so forth in there. I mean, do you think that has some influence on, I guess you could say, our cultural attention span?
I think it does, but I think the bigger issue here is an issue of class, which is that 9/11 mainly happened to middle class people. Uh-huh. There may well have been upper class there as well, but it wasn't something that was happening to desperately poor people. And the middle class have the voice. We have the access to know that we have human rights. I have lawyer friends. I can get them on the phone right now. I know how to contact the media and get my story out to the media. I can call the cops and they'll actually come. And it was quite interesting because I was involved with an animated TV series a few years ago. It was South Africa's first big animated TV series, and it was called Urbo, The Adventures of Pax Africa. And we did some market research, and it was set in kind of a dystopian, very Moxieland-y world. And we had these kind of police robots, and we were doing testing with kids from different areas, from urban areas and rural areas and lower class and middle class and upper class and Indian and black and white and, you know, from really all over the country. And we tried to show that these robots were kind of really oppressive and that there's this minor traffic accident and all these traffic robots arrive and they want to, like, break it up and arrest the guy. And kids coming from kind of middle class and rich schools were like, oh, yeah, no, that's bad, that's oppressive. And kids coming from the poor townships were like, no, no, the cops are good because they actually came.
Yeah.
And it's killing. I mean, you don't think of the world working that way because you're so cosseted in your cozy middle class existence. And I really wanted to confront that, I guess. I think I've got completely off the topic, but yeah. But yeah, I mean, technology is a voice. You know, I mean, like in South Africa, we have a very vocal Twitterati and they're very cool, but they're mainly middle class, mainly white. There are quite a few black people as well, but again, they're middle class. We just, you don't hear the poor having a voice, and especially not through technology. And I think that's what counts right now. That's where you find your voice.
Interesting.
And of course, the conditions they're living in makes it very impossible to even have access to that technology. So
right. Completely. What's interesting is cell phones, I think, are going to change everything. Again, another project I was involved with was this cell phone literacy project called Yoza.Novi. And it's cell phone novels given away for free. And, you know, just about, I think we have a 98% cell phone, whatever, ratio in South Africa. Like 98% of the population have cell phones. And suddenly that's going to make a really, really tremendous difference. And I think, you know, I think if kids start using Mixit or Twitter or that kind of thing, that could really make a really big difference to this country and to people having a voice. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about that. I hope that changes.
There's actually a program that they're trying to start in Haiti after the earthquake now for mobile banking to be entirely contained on the cell phone, because they've recognized that a population that doesn't necessarily have a bank account still has a cell phone. And can therefore utilize it for things that, you know, middle-class people take for granted, like being able to get investments and whatnot for small businesses. So I have to completely agree. Our last kind of quick, not last question, but real quick. You've also included, I got to the end of the book, and I was really excited to see that you've created an album to go along with the novel. And it's composed primarily of kwaito. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly as well.
Yes, sir.
And I thought it was really interesting. I went and researched what kwaito was myself, but if you could real quick tell people what kwaito is and why you decided to use it to characterize the novel.
Kwaito is kind of essentially a slowed down house. It's very, I guess it came about in kind of the early 90s. I'd have to check my music history. And I'm sure my music journalist friends are sighing and rolling their eyes right now. but it's very characteristic of Johannesburg. It's a very distinctive Johannesburg sound. And I really wanted the novel to evoke that feel of Johannesburg. So I used some classic tracks from Brown Dash and Ishmael. But it's also mixed up with more kind of interesting recent stuff. There's some electronica and electro in there as well. And it was just really important for me to be able to evoke the sense of the city, especially if people are unfamiliar with the city. And because the book is so tied up with the music industry, I really wanted to bring in that element as well. And it was really cool. I worked with Honey Bee, who's a producer at African Dope, and we picked out the track. She threw open their entire catalog and got access to a bunch of other music companies as well, like Ghetto Love and Kaleido Sound. And, you know, I just had freedom to choose whatever I wanted that I felt matched the mood of the album. And then she would make suggestions, we put stuff together, and I'm so pleased with the way it's come out. I'm really thrilled. And it's really nice to also be able to highlight South African music. So yeah, it was just fun.
It's a super cool addition to a book, you know. I loved that I got there and I was like, oh, music! We don't get a lot of African-influenced music in the United States, at least not on a broad scale. If you hunt for it, it's there, but
and also
I
you probably
get it from NPR, so...
Yeah. And you might typically get the kind of very tribal-based stuff, you know, the very kind of world music.
Well, that's what's interesting is NPR, National Public Radio, recently has occasionally started highlighting the much more modern African music in terms of the rap scene and kwaito and whatnot. So it's been really interesting to be introduced to that. And the only way that I've been introduced to that is through this, you know, very middle-class methodology, but you know, a lot of the music is very much not necessarily low class, but a very urban sort of sound. So
definitely. And what's actually interesting as well is that kwaito and a lot of kind of those you know, hip hop and R&B in South Africa really skipped CD altogether. Well, sorry, they skipped MP3s, the internet. So bands went from selling albums out of the back of their car, CDs out of the back of their car, skipped the internet entirely because the population don't have access to that, and went straight to selling on cell phone. And it's a massive industry, downloading songs onto your cell phone.
That's absolutely fascinating, because that's not even that common here yet. I mean, it is, but most people still have MP3 players as opposed to cell phones that act as MP3 players. So, okay.
Well, I guess that's changing, though, with the iPhone.
It is,
and
oh,
all these
sure.
smartphones, but it there is still, you know, I mean, everybody goes to iTunes and they order all their stuff from iTunes. They don't necessarily do it from their phones. Yeah.
We're just way ahead of you guys.
You are. Well, it's like cell phone technology actually is like 10 years behind in the United States. Supposedly, we for whatever reason do not get the newest technology. It's been, you know, perplexing me for like 3 or 4 years now.
Well, can you blame the people that make all this stuff? It's not like they want to trade with us. The last 8 years have not been exactly great for trade.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, I guess so the last major question before we sign off is something that isn't directly related to Zoo City, but I'm very curious because you've written Moxieland, which is more of a straight sort of science fiction novel, and then Zoo City, which I would call kind of new weird. I mean, it kind of bleeds through the sort of genre lines. But I'm very curious about science fiction in South Africa, because I recently read an article in which was talking about District 6, of which, and its relationship to District 9, and they'd mentioned that there isn't really any science fiction in South Africa. And I'm wondering what you think is, why is there so little of it in South Africa? Is there a reason? Is it just because nobody wants to write it because it's boring? Or is there some grand, or is there more of it than folks over here realize?
It's very much kind of starting to happen now. I think traditionally publishers were much more interested. You know, we came out of apartheid in 94, and I think everyone was jumping in to write apartheid stories and what apartheid meant and trying to figure that out through fiction. And before that, we had struggle fiction where people were anti-apartheid and trying to get a very powerful message through there. And our fiction has always been very much kind of message-based. And I think it's only in the last couple of years that we're starting to see an explosion in genre across the board, from chick lit to crime novels, which are huge in South Africa at the moment. And I think we're starting to see science fiction take off now. It's partly because publishers weren't interested, and now that Harry Potter has been such a phenomenal success, and Twilight, and I mean, I know that's not science fiction, but publishers are seeing the possibility of other interesting books. The problem is that a lot of South African writers are still trying to write, you know, Twilight or Lord of the Rings, and instead of using a South African setting, which I think publishers would actually find really interesting. But I have read a couple of fantastic things lately. There's a young adult novel called Sidekick by Adeline Radloff, only available in South Africa, about a kind of time-traveling superheroes teenage girl sidekick. And it's light and fun and fantastic, but also has kind of dark undertones. S.L. Gray has a horror novel coming out called The Mole, and that's coming out in June in the UK. And it's very dark, and it's focused on kind of consumerism, and it's set in a South African mall in Johannesburg. And the characters are recognizably South African, and it's recognizably South Africa, but without being kind of the core focus of the story, that it's set in South Africa. It's set in a mall. And it's just a horrendous, horrific, terrifying mall. There's another book by Lily Hearn called Deadlands, which is coming out in February from Penguin, and that is a scary zombie post-apocalyptic story with, again, a YA, but interesting because it's political. The anti-zombie revolution is called the ANZ instead of the ANC. And that's quite interesting. And again, like a lot of play on consumer culture. So it's interesting to see that there are these kind of really cool books coming out with a nasty little political edge. And I really like that. And I hope we see more of that.
I do too, because I'm an academic, as they say. And one of my interests is South African literature, although I haven't studied as much of it as I would like, but it's something that I want to continue studying. And I would love to play more with, because I do science fiction right now, and I would love to play with more of the sort of genre fiction and more contemporary South African literature, such as your novels, which are now on my list of things I'm going to have to write papers about. So,
hooray. Please send them to me.
I will. When I get to it, I definitely will, which will be after I finish my thesis.
Right.
Because that darn thing has got to get done.
I know the feeling. Moxieland was my MA project, and it took me 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Fun. Fun to write a novel for an MA thesis, though. Oh, you were creative writing. So
yeah.
It's much easier to get away with creative writing for a thesis in that matter. Okay, so real quick, last question. What new projects do you have coming up, and can you tell us a little bit about them?
I'm currently working on a documentary. I'm directing a documentary on Miss Gay Western Cape, which is the biggest female impersonation pageant in the country. And that's been really, really fun. I've got some short stories coming out. I've got about 5 novels on the back burner. But the one I'm working on at the moment is an apartheid thriller about the real-life occult crimes unit.
Wow.
Who are a very, very interesting bunch of people. I actually interviewed them in Pretoria in December. The unit no longer operates. It was found to be unconstitutional, specifically because they targeted Satanism so heavily and, yeah,
wow,
religious freedom and all that stuff.
Right.
And it was absolutely fascinating to see the stuff that they go into, from kind of crazy Satanists and vilifying goths hanging out in cemeteries as being the core of evil, right through to real evil of kind of Mutti murders and you know, kind of cults who are playing with Satanism and using that as an excuse to actually kill people or do harm. And it's very interesting. They were crazy, wonderful people. I might have to do a nonfiction on them. They were so great.
Cool. So hopefully we'll get to see some, well, short stories and maybe some more novels from you soon. So
definitely.
Perfect. Well,
I'm excited. Awesome.
I am too. Very excited. Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming onto the show with us.
No, thank you. It was absolutely awesome. I had a ball.
Cool. All right. We will make sure there are links up, you know, to your website, moxieland.com, correct?
Yeah, but I think laurenbukis.com is probably better because that has Zoo City on it as well.
Okay. Well, I'll make sure then that we'll have that as well. Make sure the book trailer and all the good stuff will be up so everybody can see it. And hopefully everyone will go check out the book. So thanks again, Lauren. Awesome.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, guys.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.